The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
This talk has changed somewhat given discussions we've had over the weekend and also a change in the lineup of speakers. I don't know if people saw, we had originally expected Christine Newman Ortiz to be able to participate. And she was not able to come. She organizes with Voces de la Frontera in Milwaukee and performs great work there, great organizing work. Unfortunately, they are meeting with the mayor of Milwaukee on Monday, and they're preparing to discuss how the city can change their policing policy in regards to immigration. And so we felt like that was a valid reason for not coming down, and we allowed her to continue working on that. But we will be working with her in the future, so stay tuned. Just to say that several talks over the weekend about the rapid response networks, about the fight from Sensabrenner to Trump, have already discussed very important aspects of organizing both in 2006 and organizing today, from the confidence that a mass struggle of hundreds of thousands of immigrant workers can inspire to the anger and terror of deportations of millions of people can impose. And just as Acres Chacon provided a really good history, I suggest people listen to it, on the U.S. border controlling immigration for its economic and political interests. And during those talks and discussions, we mentioned the political context of immigration under capitalism, but I wanted to take this opportunity to lay out how socialists understand immigration or migration of humans across borders under capitalism specifically and historically, how the U.S. state has really embedded U.S. capitalism in using immigration as a political tool to divide the working class. And I'm sorry if this is a review for some of you, but reviews never hurt anybody, and I hope it's new information for some. And historically, the U.S. state has repressed immigrants on the basis of both economic status, your ability or inability to work during particular periods of crisis or boom, as well as targeting particular immigrants on the basis of their political ideas, whether that's about religion, about changing society, workers' rights, or criticisms of U.S. policy. So I'm going to try and go through all of that in about 10 minutes. And just to talk first about migration, populations have always moved to find new sources of food, or if they were pushed out by other people or by conquest, some people moved because they were interested in finding out what was going on somewhere else. So migration is not peculiar to 20th century capitalism or to early capitalism. Neither are borders. They've always existed, although through most of human history, the borders have been natural, whether it's large bodies of water, mountains, geographical ones. It's only really under capitalism, well, not only, but really under capitalism that people still migrate for the same reasons that I mentioned before, whether it's war, famine, interest in seeing what's on the other side, but also there are new reasons that make people move, the search for work, and that's the point of migration for work under capitalism really is a product of the development of labor power as a commodity, i.e. the producers or workers are separated from their ownership of the and control of the means of production, of land and tools. That's the free labor that, I don't know if people had an opportunity to go see Jen speak last night about Marxism, oppression, and racism, but that's the free labor. We're freed of any ownership, any means of production, and therefore we have to go in search of work, in search of owners or capitalists who allow us to sell our labor for a price or sell our labor because it's the only commodity that we really have to offer. And under capitalism, of course, capitalism hasn't always existed, although we're told that it's our most natural state of being. But as the defining mode of production in our society today, it shapes and informs all that we do. And therefore, capitalism strongly influences how you go to find work somewhere else in order to live and survive. And there are two contradictory tendencies under capitalism that you might be familiar with, but I think it's worth bringing up to analyze how immigration is working today. Because there's both the development and hardening of nation states or national boundaries, and at the same time, we have this tendency from the dawn of capitalist production and marketing to globalize, to expand beyond borders, to find new markets to sell crap. And the nation state really develops out of both national and international dynamics that are inherent in the capitalist mode of production. So a nation develops out of the need to create and protect industry and markets locally, to set up laws and a set of politics, cultural and social structures and economic structures to develop that nation in competition with other forces and other nations, while at the same time, capitalists need to expand markets around the world under the particular control of a nation state. And that is a state that is run by the capitalist class. And so a national capitalist class will organize to demand that their national government work in their interest, either through protectionist laws or their counterbalance of free trade, like NAFTA, or the latest versions thereof that haven't worked quite so successfully. So the nation state, or the nation as we think of it today, emerges to develop a national economy and insert that economy as forcefully as possible in the international market. And borders really then become devised to lay claim to resources, to protect those resources, and exclude other nations from accessing those resources. But at the same time, each nation is seeking markets of consumers in other nations, and each nation also is willing to find cheap labor in other countries. And of course, we can go into the details of what that looks like in further on in the discussion. And Yasmin and Carlos will talk a little bit about that. But the nation state plays an important role then in several ways when it comes to immigration, because it manages immigration status, and therefore through managing immigration status, documents and controls all workers. And I think that's important to lay out, that if you have an undocumented section of the of the workforce, then you also have a documented section of the workforce. And through both borders and immigration laws, the state manages to repress and control all workers, although, of course, immigrants and undocumented immigrants face the brunt of those repressions. And at the same time, nations kick through, break, bulldoze, and go through barriers to allow big capital to go into other nations to have access to the market. Historically, the United States has used anti-immigration laws to control the working population both economically and politically. So sometimes the focus of the laws are more economic. They'll create laws that allow workplace raids or deportations for working illegally. They'll increase the U.S.-Mexico border patrol or restrict access to social services and medical care, as we've seen in the 1990s from up to today, especially during an economic crisis, and then seek to control the movement of workers under guest worker programs, which we can go into if people have questions about that. But then there's sometimes more explicit political focus to anti-immigration laws, such as the Patriot Act in 2001, that initially targeted immigrants for being from countries that espoused terrorists, which often meant Palestinians or Arabs, or target Islamic fundamentalists, meaning anyone being or looking Muslim. And today, of course, the Muslim ban that was just approved by the Supreme Court is explicitly political in normalizing racial profiling and justifying U.S. attacks on countries of Muslim populations. So both of these types of anti-immigration laws work in conjunction to decrease political and economic power. And true to its history, the majority of immigration laws today in the United States are heavily charged with racism. They foment racial profiling by authorities and encourage that in the general population. And of course, we've seen that today. So there's overlap between economic and political scapegoating, but the main thrust of these laws is to weaken and silence dissent, and by doing so, force the general population, both native and immigrant, to accept lower wages, poorer working conditions, a devastated social safety net, racist and nationalist rhetoric, and the state, the U.S. state, committing violence both domestically and abroad. So, for example, although the Muslim ban may initially be used against Muslim immigrants entering the country from specific nations, it also lays the groundwork ideologically and materially to silence political dissent from all sectors of society. And like I said, it naturalizes the war on terrorism and reasserts a very limited and patriarchal ideal of who the family is that people have fought so hard to undermine. Trump's racist attacks on immigrants, specifically Mexican immigrants, as rapists and bad hombres, was reinforced by previously 2.5 million deportations under Obama on the basis of criminality. Okay. An official Obama policy was, we'll only go after the immigrants with criminal records. But that actually led to Republicans to counter with the idea that all undocumented criminal immigrants are criminals. The Trump administration's executive orders have terrorized immigrant communities into silence, but I would argue that Obama's policies and both prior Democratic and Republican administrations laid the groundwork for that repression against immigrants from all countries. And just to lay out a socialist position, as socialists, we are for workers having all the freedom to travel, live, and work anywhere we want. When Marx talked about workers of the world unite, that's a fundamental principle of socialism, that international workers need to have solidarity, and national borders shouldn't be used to pit workers of one nationality or ethnic background against one another. And therefore, we don't advocate any immigration controls. We don't accept the idea that immigration does need to be controlled somehow, because I feel that, so we don't agree with the idea, like Clinton said, that our borders are leaking like a sieve, or that the Democrats and Republicans say the borders are out of control, because that leads to more state-sanctioned repression, not reforms and amnesty. And I think a lot of times we're criticized as not being realistic, but I think conceding to the rhetoric of the borders are out of control really leads us down the path that we see today, where we're seeing many more attacks and many more deportations. And so I'll just end with this thought. I don't know if people saw Hari Kondabolu last night. I'm not saying we need to subscribe to that method of legislative compromise by insinuating that we have to like have free range, take out organs of the 99% or of the 1%. I think that we, you know, in practice, we have to, you know, have some amount of realism. But we do want to get to the point where we can really start talking about our position as socialists on immigrants, leading us to say, yes, we want to work with groups who seek immigration reform under capitalism. I think a united front method is key and important to organizing. But that means organizing with liberals and groups to the right, and also against, by challenging ideas that say we have to accept the logic of, for example, comprehensive immigration reform. We don't have to accept the parameters of national security and lock down the borders of the debate, because leading to that leads to the good immigrant wait in line versus bad immigrant get out of the Bush and Obama eras, which sets the stage for where we are today and where we're not really seeing people talking about immigration reform, but simply about defending against the worst of deportations and anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rhetoric. I'll let Yasmin and Carlos elaborate on some of the things that I brought up, but I wanted to give that broad view so that that could be the basis for how socialists see the fight around immigration rights.
Hey, comrades. So I just wanted to thank my comrades for inviting me to speak on this panel when there was an opening to do so. It was kind of a last minute thing, so I wrote down a lot of thoughts, but the extent to which they cohere is yet to be determined. So apologies in advance if anything sort of seems out of place, but I'll try my best. So I'm gonna talk mostly about the Muslim ban specifically, and what I wanna do is sort of talk about its relationship to Islamophobia more broadly, and Islamophobia's relationship to war and imperialism specifically. I don't think we can have a conversation about the Muslim ban without mentioning those things. And then I want to talk more specifically about just the way that this, the meaning of this ban under the Trump administration and the political utility of the ban. As y'all likely know, one of the pillars of Trump's campaign in 2016 was Islamophobia. Trump's campaign campaigned on fear, hate, and chauvinism. He promised to surveil Muslim communities and mosques. He promised to torture Muslims. He promised to fill Guantanamo Bay up again when it had been, although not closed, there were people being released. And he promised a ban on Muslims coming into the country. And so one of the first things that he did when he came into office was to try and apply that ban through an executive order, banning Muslims in the first iteration of the ban from seven countries, which are majority Muslim, and suspending the refugee program, which, as we all know, is incredibly crucial and needs to be expanded, not shut down. So the ban has since gone through multiple iterations, and now, after the most recent sort of Supreme Court decision to allow partial implementation of the ban until the case has been heard, essentially bans people from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. Anyone who's not able to demonstrate, quote, a bona fide connection to the U.S., which is a limited category. Although it's not quite as severe as the original iteration, it's obviously an awful, awful ban that will impact people in horrific ways, particularly refugees, and we should continue to oppose it. I just want to first mention that I think, and I think the other people on the panel, comrades, will be able to speak to this more, is that this isn't unique to Trump. Trump is basically just expanding what Obama has been doing for years, and Bush before him. And so one example of this that I think is really illustrative is the fact that Trump's Muslim ban, listing seven Muslim majority countries from which he wanted immigrants to not be able to come in, included five Muslim majority countries that Obama had been regularly bombing with drones, and two others which Obama targeted with sanctions. So the parallels between these policies, between Obama and Trump, are due to the fact that Islamophobia and the bloody war on terror have a trajectory that precedes Trump's campaign. The wave of hate and fear which helped to carry Trump to the presidency resulted from a long-lasting bipartisan commitment to U.S. military intervention in Muslim-majority countries, particularly in the Middle East, which could never be politically explained or justified without the ideology of Islamophobia, which casts Muslims as subhuman, violence-prone radicals who would come after us if we don't come after them. That's essentially the ideology and the assertion that Islamophobia makes. And this is why we can't count on the Democrats to be the ones to oppose Trump or his Islamophobic policies in any effective way. And that's because they've been doing this already, and simply just haven't been saying it out loud in the same ways that Donald Trump has been doing. Not only have they been killing these people, they've not been allowing refugees into this country, and have have targeted people in these countries for war, and this is the only way to explain it, is to call them terrorists, and therefore make it possible to justify a ban like Trump's. Another indication that we really can't count on the Democrats is the recent decision by the Supreme Court, which essentially upholds most of the ban, which is almost anonymous. So liberals and conservatives on the court made this decision together, and they issued it without indicating who wrote the decision or what their explanation for it is, essentially. That means that we can't just wait for the right judge to be in place for these bans and these attacks on Muslims to be stopped. Both liberal and conservative judges on the court became accomplices in the ban when that decision was made, and are avoiding accountability for that fact. And while the reality is, how am I doing on time? Okay. The reality is that there is no evidence that the Muslim immigrants are a threat to American society, or that refugees are a threat to American society. They continue to insist on applying these kinds of policies. They can't point to a single refugee and say, this guy committed an act of violence motivated by terrorism or whatever. They can't point to a single one, but they insist on saying that these are terrorists, these people are dangerous, and we have to ban them. And I think there are a few reasons for that, and I want to talk about those reasons. One reason is I think just part of like Trump's strategy, and I would welcome comrades to sort of comment on this idea. But I think he puts us on the defensive. He carries out these really aggressive, extreme attacks, that leaves us in a position where we're at this point negotiating for grandmothers to be exempt from the ban, as people might have heard, which just happened, was an attempt on the part of Hawaii, and was not successful. The ban is also has a propagandistic sort of purpose. It broadly asserts that Muslims are a threat and puts us in that in the public discourse in a very big way. So we end up negotiating, you know, why are you not letting grandmas? Just don't let in the 15-year-old or the 20-year-old who might have gone to mosque too many times, or whatever bullshit these Islamophobic ideas spread out. And so putting the ban into the world this way just reasserts Islamophobic ideas, put them into policy, and it mongers fear in the public, particularly those who are already maybe considering Islamophobic ideas or succumbing to them, or have these arguments in their lives. When it becomes policy to ban Muslims from the country, it ends up being in people's conscience that Muslims are some sort of threat, or at least some of them are. And I think the ban, it moves discourse and the parameter of debate to the right. And that's sort of convenient for the Democrats in a lot of ways. Its initial form is such an extreme measure that whatever compromise the Democrats and liberals reach is, while likely to be extreme, they're able to tout as an accomplishment. And thirdly, and very importantly, I think the ban is the embodiment of Trump's politically opportunistic scapegoating of Muslim. The reality is that Trump's promises to working class people related to jobs and prosperity and opportunity and all that stuff will not be fulfilled, and they haven't, and they will not come to fruition. And because Trump's actual agenda is to further enrich the rich, and to make conditions so that people are being exploited at worse and worse rates, and the promises of improved living standards actually end up delivering worse living standards. So because Trump has not and will not be able to provide jobs, let alone gainful jobs, he will not be able to improve the living standards of those who voted for him. And in all likelihood, he will ensure the further decline for those living standards. And so instead, Trump will deliver the false sense of security to a fictional threat that he claims Muslims to be. And the other point that I want to make, how am I doing on time?
5 minutes.
So the other point I want to make is that the Muslim ban is another abdication of the U.S.'s responsibility for the realities in places like Afghanistan and the Middle East, for the instability and the ongoing war in these regions. The reality is that many people who are immigrating or fleeing to the United States are refugees and are people who are fleeing either the awful economic conditions or the ongoing militarism and war that was created and exacerbated by U.S. Foreign policy in the region. And I think a really excellent example of that is the reality in Iraq in particular, which was recently removed from the list, but worth mentioning nonetheless. The Iraq war caused an amazing amount of instability, as people know, but it also created, made it possible for the infiltration and the continued growth of terror organizations like ISIS, something that is an important historic fact that we should remember and that allows us to give responsibility to the United States for the horrors that people are going through there, is the fact that it was the U.S.'s policy to expel people from the Ba'athist regime in Iraq. And that expulsion meant that many tens of thousands of people in Iraq were left unemployed, without opportunity. It was done along sectarian lines, because the regime organized itself along sectarian lines, and it meant that there was a group of people who was now without any access to process, to democracy, to engaging in the public, not to mention the entire destruction of the structure of the country and civil society and social structures. And those were people who played a fundamental role in the creation and the growth of ISIS in Iraq. And so, rationally speaking, we can't not blame the United States for this reality. And therefore, we must demand that not only does the United States end its war on terror and all its military involvement anywhere in these regions, but to also let refugees in and take accountability for the violence and desperation that the country has caused. So I just want to mention a couple of things that I think we should note about how we should move forward. The initial rejection of the ban, the legal rejection of the ban, I don't think we should think that was because of the legal maneuvers of lawyers. I'm nothing against lawyers. I think they do important work. But they could not have had the success that they did without the swell of resistance and solidarity that existed around the ban. This is a fact that we really need to remember. And we're not going to have any success, certainly since it's been made obvious that the Supreme Court is not on our side and is not on the side of Muslims, unless we continue to take to the streets, continue to take to the airports, and show up in numbers, in solidarity with Muslims, and against the ban in order for us to have any kind of success in being able to defeat this ban, whether it takes the shape of the right kind of decision from the Supreme Court doesn't indicate that it was a legal success. It indicates that it was a success of a movement in solidarity with Muslims. And I'm sure comrades remember those kinds of protests that took place when the ban was first ordered, with thousands of people showing up at airport terminals while Muslims were being detained and interrogated and harassed. Protesters, both Muslim and non-Muslim, were outside chanting in solidarity with them, welcoming them, organizing welcome brigades and organizing lawyers to meet with them and making it possible for them to get out of there and on the other side. And this is the kind of thing that we need to continue doing. Another really great example of resistance, I think, is the strike on the part of Yemeni workers in New York City, which people might have heard of, where Yemeni workers workers and business owners shut down their stores for a day and showed up by the hundreds, along with many people in solidarity with them, and made it clear that they refuse to be relegated to the margins. They refuse to be profiled, and their families deserve to be able to see them, and they don't want to live in the insecurity of something like the ban. So these are, I think, are examples that we should be learning from and looking to, and the way that we have forward, because the court doesn't have this idealized conscience around the law. It's a question of where social movements are. It's a question of our ability to mobilize effectively. I want to remind people of the sign at these protests that said, first they came for the Muslims, and we said, not this time, motherfucker. It's a pretty good one. And I think it says a lot, because the reality is that the most vulnerable people are the primary targets, but they're not the only targets. The rest of us, if they are able to profile people in the way that they want to profile Muslims, none of us is safe. And lastly, I just want to talk about all the reasons why it makes sense for there to be solidarity between Muslims and immigrants, other sorts of immigrants in this country, and that is because it is the same institutions that oppress us both, that surveil us both, that go after us and disrupt our homes and our families and take us away from our homes and our families. Those are institutions that we both need to work together to dismantle, and that's the only way to be able to win this fight, and to recognize that it's part of an ongoing assault against all kinds of communities, whether it's women, LGBTQ people, immigrants, Muslims, etc., who are serving as the scapegoats and the explanation for an elite that has failed on a regular basis to address the needs of the masses of people. And so we must refuse to be divided in this way and insist on solidarity with each other, and to make it clear that we are not the reason why living standards and social conditions are the way they are in this country. It's corporations, it's capitalism, it's Trump and people like him, it's the Democrats and the Republicans, and maybe we can instate a ban on them. So.
Yeah, so thank you so much to Yasmin again for being able to like step in like last minute and being able to like be part of this panel. Because I think that's very important to talk about the connections between what the band is and what it is. Thanks again. Last month during a congressional hearing, Thomas Homan, who is the acting director of ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, had a chilling warning for immigrant communities. And I quote, if you're in this country illegally and you committed a crime by being in this country, you should be uncomfortable. You should look over your shoulder. You need to be worried. No population is off the table. Right. So that quote goes hand in hand with this administration's plan to cultivate a climate of fear for immigrants, to create a world in which it means that being an immigrant, a refugee, or a Muslim, in this America, means that you have to fear for your safety, whether you're at work, whether you're running errands, whether you're even at home. Right, so since the inauguration of Trump in late January, many of the fears and anxieties of what a Trump presidency can mean for a majority of working people have become all too real. And I think it's very, very clear that not many communities have experienced this as deeply as immigrants and refugees and Muslims. So from the first few days since Trump came into power, as others have laid out, we saw him draft and sign several executive orders, including the construction of the border wall, which is the premise of this talk, according to a report I saw from the G20 conferences, which is like sort of like the ruling class's version of like this conference, he's still shouting about how he wants Mexico to pay for it, so like he's still going on that. So at least for Mexico is here, so maybe he can talk about how that's going for Trump. So there's the travel bans on Middle Eastern and Arab nations, which you know, were just highlighted and which were defeated twice through resistance, which, you know, I'll come back to that a little bit later. Which, you know, as we just heard, saw a new life in the Supreme Court after parts of it were cleared. And we've also seen an escalation of ICE raids, as well as threats to defund sanctuary cities, not to mention the street harassment and violence towards immigrants and Muslims through the growth of an emboldened right wing, which, you know, I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. But yeah, so people may have heard that ICE has been targeting immigrants applying for green cards outside of court offices. You know, and so one high-profile example of this was in Lawrence, Massachusetts earlier this year when, you know, folks were showing up for their scheduled appointments to apply and, you know, were taken by ICE agents. And not only is this inhumane, but it's also specifically a tactic of intimidation and, you know, to discourage people from seeking, you know, quote-unquote legal ways to stay in the country after, you know, what Bridget talked about is, like, you talk about like this dynamic between the good and bad immigrants and how you have to wait in line. Well, we're trying, right? But this is what's happening. You know, I saw a story recently on the Sun-Times or the Tribune, you know, I get those two rags confused, but that a story, you know, that there have been reports of immigrant women being fearful of reporting instances of domestic abuse for fear of deportation. So in this country, a domestic abuser has more rights than undocumented folks, right? So what does that tell you? We know about the work raids that ICE has been organizing. You know, they've been going on since the days of Bush. But one that, like, I found really alarming happened a few months ago in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when ICE agents stopped by a restaurant in the morning to look for an employee who happened to not be working there that day. So then ICE agents sit down and have a fucking meal. And after they're done eating, go back and arrest three employees, take them into custody. Right? So again, like this anxiety of like, you're not even safe, you know, you're not safe at work no matter what. These are all part of waves of escalations of arrests that we've seen under Trump. So last month, nearly 200 immigrants in Southern California were detained as part of a five-day operation to target undocumented folks. And you know, one of the most frightening instances of the terror that immigrant communities face is something that happened here in Chicago back in March. Folks may have seen reports that, you know, in the north side neighborhood of Belmont Cragen, ICE agents showed up at a home of a man named Felix Torres. So they knock on the door. He, you know, opens the door, and an ICE agent opens fire and shoots him in the arm, right? And so then after, like, you know, after reports had come out, ICE was claiming that they, you know, they only shot after Felix, like, pointed a gun at them. But everyone in the household was saying that no one in the family even has a gun, right? So that wouldn't be the first time that the state has lied about like the reason for shooting somebody, right? Right, so these examples of terrorizing immigrant communities have resulted in an increase of detentions and arrest of undocumented folks by over 40% under Trump. And what's worse, month after month, data has shown that around half of the immigrants rounded up in the raids by ICE have either only committed minor offenses, such as like traffic violations, or often have no criminal record at all. Right, so contrary to like the dominant narrative, like the bad hombre, that like folks who are being detained are, you know, like criminals, or, you know, being deported because there's some sort of like a risk to public safety or like being guilty of being violent. Well, between January 22nd, the Monday after Trump came into power, and the beginning of May, ICE had conducted around 10,800 non-criminal arrests compared to 4,200 in the same span of time in 2016, which is an increase of more than 150%. And in cities such as Atlanta, non-criminal arrests of immigrants have risen over five times since last year already. Right, so I mentioned, you know, these examples that I mentioned are only a few ways in which, so these are only a few ways in which the Trump administration has become a living nightmare for many. Right, so we already, you know, we already talked about some of the executive orders, such as, you know, some of the things that he did was to expedite the prioritization of deportations for folks who, you know, have been convicted of minor crimes or have not been convicted of a crime but merely charged, or that ICE thinks like will be guilty of committing a crime. He's also also plans on hiring 10,000 more ICE officers and 5,000 more Border Patrol agents to further militarize a border that is already an incredibly dangerous zone for folks and has resulted in the deaths of thousands. Like, the numbers are staggering of how many people are dying along the border. And also publicizing crimes committed or allegedly committed by undocumented immigrants to sort of like further cultivate this like narrative of like, you know, like the fear of undocumented folks. You know, we talked about the travel ban, which, you know, would restrict folks from majority Muslim countries. Would halt the refugee program, which, you know, as Yasmin talked about, is essential for folks who are like trying to leave just like some of the worst conditions. But this ramping up of immigration enforcement, as well as scapegoating and fear mongering. It was actually part of Trump's campaign, right? It's nothing new. His Make America Great Again slogan and his anti-immigrant rhetoric was it redirected a very, very, very true like class anger that was there. But instead of like focusing that on like the, you know, on the banking institutions that collapsed the world economy, or the fact that we have, you know, a neoliberal assault that has crushed social infrastructure for 40 years, it placed all of that blame and tried to shift it to scapegoating immigrants. And although like Trump has shown his ineptitude as a head of state in almost every way imaginable, his campaign promises on immigration enforcement and on the banning of Muslims has seen some success. And I think the reason for that is quite simple. As folks have laid out, the Democratic Party and Obama built and outfitted a deportation machine that Trump and his team are now using to terrorize the undocumented. And actually, it's like quite clear when you look at everything that the Democratic Party cannot be relied on to be allies for the undocumented. So just really quickly, Obama, known in these parts as the Deporter-in-Chief, displaced 2.5 million immigrants and increased federal funding to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security by 300% as far as like an enforcement first approach to the question of immigration. This is Obama, who campaigned on immigration reform and instead managed to deport more human beings that have been displaced by every president combined in the entire 20th century. His secure communities program made it possible to detain undocumented immigrants in record numbers by putting them on a pathway to deportation for committing minor offenses. And secure communities actually laid the groundwork for what Obama is, for what Trump is able to do now, right? So, you know, there was also the Obama's administration's shameful response to the surge of thousands of Central American refugees that were seeking asylum, many of them unaccompanied children, a couple years ago, who were sent held in cruel detention centers only to be sent back to a crisis that their families attempted to escape. And that crisis was just like the one in the Middle East, was only made possible to a rooted history of American foreign policy and the role in which U.S.-backed governments destabilized regions all over the world. So again, this model of scapegoating and enforcement, I'm gonna have to speed up a bit, but is not unique. It actually goes hand in hand with the role of borders and immigration enforcement under capitalism, which Bridget talked about. And that is that those are tools to manipulate and regulate working people, right? Borders don't protect citizens. What they do is they criminalize immigrants. They are socially constructed boundaries used to sustain inequality through racist divisions that further marginalize the minority and blame them for the unsustainable nature of this system that thrives off these divisions and, you know, has its very foundation on the exploitation of working class. Let's see. So, you know, as socialist, I'm skipping some things. So capital and wealth are able to flow through these borders without restriction, yet people fleeing poverty and war aren't. And that's why, you know, socialist support, the right of all people to move across borders without fear of discrimination, as Bridget talked about. The current climate of and the racist structures that we have to try to dismantle and fight against may seem pretty daunting, but we've already seen glimpses of and flashes of what the resistance can look like, from the airport protests that were just highlighted, that many comrades in the ISO like helped organize and were a part of, to like the marches such as the one in Milwaukee back in February that brought out thousands of folks books and closed hundreds of businesses. Today's of actions that revived the calls for a day without immigrant, the mass movement of millions that we saw back in 2006 that successfully shut down one of the most draconian anti-immigrant laws that were ever tried to put into effect. Here in Chicago, there's groups like Protect Rogers Park, which are creating these rapid response networks, in order to turn out the community in order to protect folks from ICE raids, similar to what we saw earlier in Trump's, when Trump came to power, trying to deport a woman in Arizona, and the community came out and attempted to block that deportation. And that shows a sort of like way of, there was a talk on emergency response networks. So if folks write that, hopefully we can bring more examples of that. But these emergency response networks are a crucial organizing vehicle because, they're drawing out hundreds of thousands of people who say that they're ready to come out and commit themselves to blocking deportations. And that's actually one way that we can disrupt Trump's deportation machine. But it can't end there. There's also the victories that we can learn from the past immigrant rights movement. So there's the program such as Deferred Action, which it stopped well short of what we needed as far as the calls from the immigrants' rights movement, but it gave a relief from deportation as well as the right to work legally and among other things to young immigrants. And that wasn't something that was actually just awarded by Obama. It was It was fought for by undocumented youth who were, came out and said, we're undocumented and we're unafraid, and they're like risked arrest and blocked traffic and such, and that's what we have to sort of like revive, that sort of like history of like radicalism in the immigrants' rights movement. Hopefully folks can talk more about that. There's also like the movement in the 80s that won the right for sanctuary spaces. Which was rooted in religious and radical organizing in the 80s. It was in solidarity with the crisis again in Central America over folks fleeing violence and despair. But today, sanctuary cities have been under attack since Trump got into office. Attorney General Jeff Sessions trying to pull federal funding from more than 100 cities, including Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles and Seattle. If they don't stop. I don't have time to get too much into it, so we can maybe talk about it more into discussion as far as what sanctuary spaces mean. But what does this all mean for socialism? Let me go a couple minutes over. Is that the key task for socialists is to project all of these examples of that we learn from history as part of our role of being the sort of collective memory of the working class. It is to connect the different struggles along with the fight for immigrant justice, to connect the intersections between deportation, between racism, and the exploitation of all workers under capitalism. I guess great minds think alike, because I was also going to end with the workers of the world unite line. But when Karl Marx and Engels wrote that, what they meant was that it was only through solidarity and unity that we can all create a world in which exploitation, inequality, oppression, and endless war and occupation, and the inhumanity of deportations can cease to exist. So by making connections between immigrant justice groups, labor unions, community organizations, and building a strong left that is actually dedicated to fighting all instances of oppression, we can actually make these loud calls to stop deportations, to strike down the travel bans, to seize the terrorizing of immigrant communities, to call for amnesty, to fight for a world without borders. Because through solidarity, we can tear down any wall and we can melt ice. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.